You're listening to Girovagando by the Cycling Podcast. Today we are in Torino.
Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine. Non spigudeci ora, non spigudeci ora.
Ciro, there's not the Giro without Ciro. Ciro Scognamiglio, how do you feel at the start of this Giro?
Good, because I already arrived here in Venaria Reale in Turin 2 days ago, and I already started my personal countdown.
I can see you've got your notebook, your lovely coral blue notebook here, and as is tradition on the Giro, you've got a countdown on the back page. There's not much else in the notebook yet, because it's the first day, but you have got a list of stages, and you're already, I think, why have you already struck off 3 stages? This is day one, Ciro.
No. For me, the day one, as I already told you, is on Tuesday when I arrived here. And my last day is not the day in Rome, but the day after. Because remember, dear listeners, the real Giro ends when I enter again in my on a beach, but mainly when I enter for the first time after the Giro in my apartment.
Ciro, I'm worried about a couple of things going into this Giro. One of the things I'm worried about is this this seismic activity, the volcano, the possible eruption in what's it called, Campi Flegre?
Yes.
We talked about the super volcano that might erupt, and there's lots of, as I say, activity over the last few days. And there are some people getting really worried about this.
No. I can assure you that during the Giro, nothing will happen, and I think that nothing serious will happen in the next more or less 100 years. I have some sources, good sources,
well,
also near the volcano.
You're the most reliable journalist around, whether it's transfer speculation or transfer scoops on Twitter or super volcanoes.
Yeah.
So we believe you.
Yeah, thank you, and have a nice Giro, and I hope to come back soon in this podcast. That year after year,
you don't have any choice in the matter.
Yes, exactly, but also because it remains my reason on life and maybe the main reason for which I'm in here.
Gli ultimi 10 secondi, allora, prima di andare, tutti insieme, 10, 9, 8, 7,
6, 5,
4, 3, 2, 1, parte la 116ª edizione della Giro d'Italia.
Schachman met een gooi naar Rose, Pogacar van op de kop. Machtig sterk, Pogacar, maar daar komt Narváez. Narváez komt dreigend, Narváez erover. De Ecuadoraan op weg naar Rose. Of komt Schachman op de Pogacar die opnieuw komt. En dan is het Rose voor Ecuador.
In Engels. What's your name?
My name is Marco. Marco Antonio. Marco Antonio Barreto.
Ecuadoriano with a Torino accent. Have you lived a long time in Torino?
Yeah, of course. I'm living here. I came here when I was 6 years, and now I'm 30, and so I'm living here 24 years old. And for me, it's a dream, and so happy that an Ecuadorian win the first race here in Turin. And so good luck, really, really good luck.
Your English is excellent. You were insistent that you couldn't do an interview in English because it wasn't good enough. Your English is really good, so congratulations. So a big emotion for you. Are there many Ecuadorians in Torino?
So here in Torino we are a little bit, no, not too much Ecuadorian, but I'm so sure that all the Ecuadorians, not only in Turin, but in other cities of Italy, they are sending energy to our Ecuadorian winner. So we are so grateful and excellent. Good luck, of course.
Brian, il barone, buonasera, buon Giro 2024, welcome to the 2024 Giro d'Italia.
With buonasera.
The Cycling Podcast. Welcome, that was Ciro welcoming us to the Giro d'Italia. It was Ciro, it was the nation of Ecuador. What a lovely vignette that was from the start of Venaria Reale this morning, the countdown to the start. Then we heard another friend of ours, Renat Schotter of Sportza. He was standing next to me in the pen. At the finish line, commentating on the closing meters of an absolutely pulsating first stage of the Giro d'Italia. And then we heard from an Ecuadorian in Turin, who was a very proud man this evening, for reasons we'll find out about in just a moment. Brian, how are you?
The talented Mr. Freebie. I'm so well. I've been looking forward to naming you that.
But this implies that I'm somehow mysterious and possibly a con man, which I'm not.
No, just actually, you should just take it from what it says, that you're a very talented man.
This feels barbed.
I know you're not a murderer.
It feels barbed. And Brian, describe the scene for us and where we are, please.
Well, Daniel, we're sitting on this really nice cobble street, just on the other side of the Gran Madre de Dio, this neoclassical building that's just adjacent to the finish line. You know, one of my tasks of the day is to find a good spot for recording. Yeah, well, I've been going for numerous walks today, and one of them found me this place, and it's called Bar Briac, which I think would be short for the drunken bar.
And, the locals are all enjoying their aperitivi. Brian, we're just adjacent to the finish line, which is on Corso Casale. I ran up Corso Casale earlier, past the Fausto Coppi monument we heard about, I think, in our Giro preview.
Isn't that the Corso Moncalieri?
I think they join there. There's a point where they join, and there's this big sort of spiral Fausto Coppi monument with like bits of rock from the Croix de Fer and other places where Fausto Coppi did memorable rides. This place sort of drenched in history, cycling history, sporting history. Italian history. We're going to talk about Superga later again at the end of the episode, because we know it was an important day for Superga in the city of Turin and Torino Football Club. But I said it was a pulsating first stage. It really was. And it reminded me a little bit of the last time we were here for the Giro d'Italia, when we had that sort of circuit racing. What was not the most exciting Giro d'Italia, but we had a fantastic stage in Torino. It was one of those stages in sort of screaming technicolor as well today. It felt like a Giro d'Italia stage. Beautiful landscape, beautiful shots of Superga. A finale that was sort of every bit as gripping as a Milan-San Remo, for example.
It was ridden like a classic, really, wasn't it? And that's the type of racing that we like. And, you know, there's often the tradition of starting with a prologue or, you know, a sprinter stage. But this is like head on. This could potentially be one of the most memorable stages, at least in the first part of the Giro, I think.
And
I hope I'm wrong, obviously.
Well, crucially as well, with a surprising twist, a plot twist, a surprising denouement, which we're going to hear about. Well, let's hear about it now, shall we? In what's a new feature, doing what the sort of old feature at this point in the podcast used to do.
It's a tribute, isn't it,
Daniel? Il processo alla tappa, the post-stage inquisition.
Brian, Processo alla Tappa, we're very unoriginal because we have ripped off the name. I have ripped off the name of a long-standing feature on Italian television, Italian Giro coverage. They've had Il Processo alla Tappa for a long time. The idea is it's kind of a court case, it's kind of an inquest into what happened in the Giro d'Italia. This was part of Giro coverage in Italy, where it started in 1962, and then it recommenced in 1998 after a bit of a hiatus. And it is very well, it's a very beloved feature of Rai's coverage of the Giro d'Italia, isn't it?
It is, and it's something that I've come to like a lot, especially when I'm not at the race, which luckily is. It's been a while. I just think it's a good tradition. It's sort of the, whenever there's polemica, whenever there's debacle, whenever there's issues, whenever there's conflict, that's really where you want to go and eavesdrop on various, I'm not saying I'm one at all, but experts, sort of the lay of the land of the Giro.
The way it's going to work, Brian, is I'm going to ask you questions. It's not going to be a monologue anymore. I'm going to ask you questions about the stage, and you have to endeavour to answer them.
To the best of my abilities.
To the best of your ability. And I will come down very hard on you.
I think you're very comfortable in this role, Daniel.
If you answer them incorrectly. Brian, where did the stage start today? Where did it finish? How many kilometres was the stage?
Well, Daniel, the first stage of the Giro started in Venaria Reale, and it finished in Torino. And it was a short one, 140 kilometres.
Brian, was there a break in the stage? And if so, tell us about that break, please.
Yes, there was, Daniel. It was actually a break that turned out to be quite significant also for the finale, because six riders went away. And parts of that breakaway sort of paved the way into the final part and actually had a big influence on who eventuated into deciding the stage.
Would you say that was the case? The break had a significant impact on, well, the final outcome of the stage. Would you say that?
Is this a leading question, Daniel?
Come on.
No. Yeah, I mean, there was a surprising turn of events, I would say, in how the race unfolded, where I was quite surprised that, you know, the earlier parts of the breakaway was still active, you know, quite late in the race. And I'm talking about Calmejan here, unless you want to ask another question.
No, I was going to ask you the other important question was, who was in the break, Brian?
So the six riders, Daniel, were Louis Barret of Arkea, De Beaumarchais of Cofidis, Lilian Calmejan of Wanty.
Wanty, sorry.
Emmanuel Gebregesia of Trek, Segafredo. Sorry, Little Trek. Andrea Petrobon of Polti and Filippo Fiorelli of Bardiani.
Brian, how long did the break, well, how long did those guys last? Who was
the last man standing was Calmejan, who actually initially got dropped when Emmanuel Gebregesia attacked on the Superga and took the mountain points. But he kind of like hung on to just cross on the Col de Maddalena, and then kept a small gap on the descent, and that was basically it. After that, it was a counterattack that turned out to be, that was probably the significant breakaway that I wanted to like hint at initially, and that was sort of what paved the way into the final of the stage.
So this counterattack, Brian, where did that happen? Who was in it?
So that was an eight-man counterattack, and it was quite interesting because it turned out that, you know, after Pogacar and UAE sort of dictated the tempo, there was a bit of a hesitation, and then there was this counterattack happened with eight riders, very strong riders actually, and I think that sort of surprised that they were able to stay away, because once the Pogacar attacked on the last climb, they bridged up to that group, and it was out of that group that we saw the winning move.
At one point, we thought that one of the members of that breakaway group, Nicola Conchi, was going to... Well, he looked well set to win the stage, because he had about... the screen was showing about a minute, and there was a shot where it was sort of a long lens shot, and you could see the peloton. Well, you could barely see the peloton, in fact, at the sort of end of the shot. And at that point, I thought Conchi was well set. He's never really won a pro race. He's won a couple of
He
had won a couple of amateur races, but I thought at that point he looked like the favourite. Brian, just tell us, please, about what happened on that San Vito. The little, I refer to it as a pimple in our preview. What do we see there?
It was almost like positioning going into the foot of that climb. And the minute that... Micah had done a lot of work. He was the last guy out there for trying to pull and set the tempo for Pogacar. And then once they basically hit the climb, Pogacar moves to the front. And then he did his fiammata, as you would say in Italian.
Attempted pogceneration.
Yeah, he started to light up the race. And he did it in...
Jean and Narvaez bought the fire extinguisher.
He did three really significant accelerations, Pogacar. And Narvaez was able to bridge up, just basically stay on his wheel, which was quite impressive, even after he sort of, both him and Schachmann, who ended up there as well, miscalculated somewhat one of the turns on that tricky descent. But that after the, I think it was a pogceneration, even if Narvaez especially was able to hang on, not for grim death, but for a good chance of winning the race.
Brian, tell us about the sprint quickly.
So the sprint was a three-man sprint, and it looked at, I mean, that's also, you know, when you have someone as important as Pogacar, you always like imagine how can anyone beat him. But not even just Narvaez who won the stage, but also Schachmann edged just in front of Pogacar, and that was the top three of the stage.
Pogacar led out sprint and he opened it out. I don't know how many meters ago, maybe 300-400.
So I think there was only like 400 meters left after the descent, final kilometer descent.
And Pogacar led out the sprint and it was a close one, wasn't it? They were sort of spread across the road, but Narváez was the fastest man. And Brian, can you tell us what the GC looks like, please? The top... tell us the top five positions, and also tell us what we haven't talked about so far is, were there any significant time losses on GC, particularly maybe concerning people who came into this race with ambitions on general classification?
Well, then I would say yes and no. I mean, obviously we have to take into consideration that this is the third stage. We have to take into consideration that there was bonification seconds, etc. But as it stands now, Jonathan Narváez of Ineos Grenadiers leads the race with 3 seconds ahead of Maximilian Schachmann of Bora Hansgrohe, Tadej Pogacar at 6 seconds, Alex Budang, first rider in the next group, with 16 seconds, Damiano Caruso in fifth, and then Nicola Conchi. And I'm mentioning those guys because they were part of that counterattack that basically decided the latter parts of the stage.
Who were the big losers on GC, Brian?
Well, the big losers, I don't think there's any big losers, but the riders who lost time, I would say significantly, was certainly Geraint Thomas, but not a big loser. He lost 20 seconds. I would say the biggest loser would be Romain Bardet.
Yeah, he lost 1 minute and 7 seconds. More about him a bit later, because I did speak to some...
Quintana as well, but I don't know what we were to expect of him. Domenico Pozzovivo actually was unfortunate to crash, made it back up again before the second last climb, but they all lost time. There's a major group coming in 1 minute and 7 seconds, and that featured Plep, Bardet, Pozzovivo, riders that we were probably thinking potentially still can be in the top five in this race. But
there was another significant loser on general classification. That was Timon Arensman of Ineos Grenadiers. He lost two minutes and 27 seconds.
Surprisingly, so he actually got dropped on the Maddalena when Mikkel Bjerg was really like putting in a huge effort at the front of the peloton.
Brian, it's an easy one today because not too much. Well, obviously, it's the first day of the general classification, so the stage result was pretty much the general classification. Points jersey, Narváez leads. King of the Mountains, Calmejan leads. The Young Riders classification, Tadej Pogacar can breathe a sigh of relief. He doesn't have to,
today.
No, which is unusual in his career, that he doesn't have to go to the mix zone and do all of that because he's not in the Young Riders white jersey. Alex Bourdin of Decathlon Âge d'Or à la Mondiale and team's classification. We don't need to pay any attention to that at this point, but Ineos Grenadiers lead. Brian, I think you've got a question for me.
Yeah, then I have a question for you. Did you talk to anyone interesting today?
Of course I spoke to a couple of riders at the finish line. I spoke to Max Schachmann. Schach is back. He was second today. And I also spoke to Geraint Thomas. And they were both in pretty boisterous mood, as you're about to hear.
Of course, I'm happy and disappointed at the same time, but I knew this sprint is hard because Poggi, we know he can sprint like hell. I race with Narváez, he's also really fast. And I hate short sprints. That's why I opened. When I got back to slipstream, I knew it would have been better to stay in the wheel. Maybe I had a tiny chance, but I think good opening stage. It was close. I mean, we were all within a bike length. It was nice to race with Poggi in such a race one time. Yeah.
Max, you really feel like this result shows that you're back at, well, your old level?
Honestly, I'm doing better than in the past. Otherwise, I wouldn't be there. But it was a tough race. Well, Poggi came like a rocket. I didn't see him coming. But also, he slowed down in the easier parts. That was the moment I understood he's also a block, full gas. Narváez also. Thanks God. Thanks my tire. In one left turn, I really f***ed it up. And I just hammered into the corner. And I have to say, I was surprised that the tire made it. Otherwise, I would be home already.
Well, Geraint, a good day. Obviously, a great day for the team. And it looked like a good day for you as well.
Personally, I felt good. Just that bit out of position into that climb, but I saw that Johnny was right there on Pog's wheel. Great ride from him, and yeah, unbelievable for the team, obviously, because great way to start. And chapeau to Johnny. We always knew he was fast, and to get over there with Pog and sprint, great for the team, great day.
How much planning had gone into that today for him particularly, and well, with the whole team thinking that he could contend for the win today?
Yeah, we were talking about that for a while in amongst the team. They told me before press conference not to mention Johnny because he'd go in the radar, but I was like, well, I think people know who he is. But yeah, fair play to him. Like, it was always going to be a day for him, and for us, the rest of us, to try and just be there in a good position. But yeah, it was great.
We saw some GC riders losing time on the Maddalena. Was there anything today that sort of surprised you about the way it was raced? I mean, Schachmann said that he was surprised he didn't go well, the pace wasn't higher on the Maddalena, yet there were guys getting dropped.
Yeah, it was a funny one. I guess it's just the first day. It's a bit of heat. It's, everyone reacts differently. And like I said at the start, you know, I think it's easy to get carried away on day one. Once we get into stage 15 onwards, this will be insignificant, you know, once we start going up those massive climbs. And, you know, as we all know, the Giro, so much can change. People just drop out quite quickly. But yeah, it's, first day is always funny, as I say, and it's different for a Grand Tour to start so aggressive, you know. So, and the bunch was nervous. It was proper sketchy at times. But then I was happy we went a bit harder up there to, you know, settle it down a bit, really.
And just finally, Geraint, Pogacar's talked this week about how he feels the rest of you have been kind of disrespected, probably by us, the media, before this race. We were talking as though it's a one-horse race. Have you felt disrespected?
I'm used to it, mate. You've never respected me. No, for me, look, I get why he's... I say the same thing, you know, look at him. He's... Oh, sorry. He's unbelievable. So, no, I definitely don't feel disrespected. If it was somebody else, like, I don't know. Well, anyone else. Yeah, yeah. Bit my tongue. Yeah, then it'd be a bit different. But, you know, this guy's phenomenal. And we all know what a major talent he is and how strong a favourite he is. And we've just got to be try and ride our race. And we know we're totally up against it. But as we saw today, his team were strong, obviously. But they weren't super dominant like they have been in some other races. So it's a long race. A lot can happen. Good start for us. All good. Sorry?
Predictions for tomorrow?
Pog's going to probably drop a bomb again. We'll see who can follow, basically. You know, Johnny's in great form. And, you know, I can't remember off the top of my head the climb, how long it is, but I think the hardest bit comes at the end. And the way Johnny's going, who knows? Maybe he can hold on. Be great if he could. But we'll see. But I think, as we saw today, that group over the top was still... fair amount of bike riders there, so I think it will be hard tomorrow, but hey, yeah, we'll see.
The cycling podcast at the 2024 Giro d'Italia is supported by MAP Cycling Apparel.
If you're following the cycling podcast on Instagram, we are The Cycling Podcast, and if you're not following, well, give us a follow. You'll have seen Daniel's video this morning of his morning run. Daniel's run is very much a part of his Giro routine, and he made a pilgrimage to Superga. And you'll have noted in that video that he was wearing a very fine MAP casquette, the cotton caps that cyclists wear. And, well, it looked good. And I gather that he was sent a consignment of MAP casquettes for the Giro d'Italia. I don't know whether this is a joke. I don't know the extent to Daniel's rider these days, whether he's insisted on a fresh casquette every day. I'd be surprised. He travels light, Daniel. He's quite a frugal fellow. But I also wouldn't blame him if he did want a fresh cap every day, because there's nothing better than new kit day, is there? And with that in mind, have a look at map.cc. It's MAAP.cc. They've recently refreshed and revamped their training jersey range, and there's a wide variety of colours, short sleeve jersey and bib shorts. And, well, the one that's really taken my eye is the very light pink, almost Giro inspired. The colour is officially musk. And, yeah, if anyone's listening from MAP, well, you've got my address. Anyway, MAP are our official clothing partners, and we'll be hearing a lot more from MAP over the course of the Giro. But for now, with the weather turning, feeling a lot more spring-like here in my corner of the UK, it's time for me to get on my bike, and I will be kitting myself out in my MAP gear. But I think one or two items could do with a little refresh, so I'm going to delve into the website, map.cc. Now, though, it's back to Daniel and Brian.
Brian, how do you think the inaugural Processo alla Tappa went? I think we'll get custard pies for that.
Well, let me say, it can only go better from here on. I was quite nervous.
Yeah.
But you were I think it was like, I would give it like a 6 out of 10.
A 6 out of 10. We will improve. We will improve on that. We wanted to make the first part of the podcast a little bit more dynamic. The long monologue is very difficult for the person doing the monologue, and it can be difficult for the listener as well to digest everything that we're trying to say. Brian, it was a great stage. We're going to talk about that stage in a minute. I asked you who the big winners and losers. We're going to get into the weeds of that in just a moment. Bit of housekeeping first. We're in Turin. We've been talking a lot in the last few days about Superga and Grande Torino. This race finishes in Rome in 3 weeks' time. And Rome, of course, the city of the Colosseum and the Pantheon. The Colosseum featured on Stacey Snyder's mugs last year. The Pantheon is one of the centerpieces. The other one is Superga in her design, her wonderful design that she's come up with for this year. And her cups are going to go on sale tomorrow, stage 2, at 10 a.m. US East Coast time, 3 p.m. UK time, and 4 p.m. Central European time. As long-time listeners will know, they are very difficult to come by, very sought after. So make sure you are ready to go with your fingers poised over the buy button on Stacey Snyder's Etsy page. We'll make sure you've got all the information you need to buy those cups on social media. Brian, the big story, the sort of non-story, I suppose, the conclusion, the denouement that we all expected, Tadej Pogacar in the pink jersey tonight. It hasn't happened. The race, the spectacle, is all the better, I suppose, for that not happening. I saw Mauro Gianetti, the UAE Team Emirates manager, at the finish line, and I sort of went up to him looking very kind of poker-faced, deliberately very poker-faced, and I said to him, Mauro, is UAE... Is it crisis? Is it sort of a crisis tonight?
That's a real journalist question.
And he sort of laughed. But Pogacar was disappointed, and we saw him wearing a black armband today. Tragically, 2 or 3 days ago, I think, a member of the junior team that he supports, the Poggy team, died in a kayaking accident, and that was why he was wearing the black armband today. That was another reason why he wanted to win. The team definitely committed. I don't think anyone would dispute that, would they? Yeah. And
But can I just say something?
Go on.
Could there be any kind of concern about the depth on that team as of today?
Well, there has been, hasn't there, before this race. And look, there were three riders left at the end. You know, Pogacar was never going to have four riders in that group. I mean, I suppose what they would have talked about on the bus this morning would be making sure that he went into that San Vito climb in perfect position. He was in perfect position. It was Micah, wasn't it, who did a great lead out to take him exactly where he needed to be at that point in the race.
Yeah, I think that was, from a GC perspective, it looked somewhat solid. But from a stage perspective, you know, when that group went, that group of eight guys, I think they went because there was only Micah left pulling for Pogacar between the second last and the last climb, which was, you know, from a GC perspective, relatively insignificant. But as the race eventuated, had he had another rider there and had he potentially had a little bit more help there, that could have meant the final throw in the sprint. I don't know. I'm just saying it because there were other teams that were a bit more represented in that bigger group. And the obvious reason is because they work their asses off. You know,
it's okay, you can swear. We've already had lots of swearing from Max Schachmann and Geraint Thomas tonight. Brian, another thing. I think it was quite an entertaining interview with Geraint Thomas. He generally does give entertaining interviews. And I asked him about the narrative that has been spun around this Giro d'Italia, that it is a one-horse race and that Tadej Pogacar is going to turn this race into a cakewalk. His reaction was quite interesting, and it mirrored we're going to hear later from Larry, our good friend Larry Warbass, and I asked him whether Ben O'Connor might feel that his nose was slightly out of joint. But Thomas looked strong. A great day for Ineos with
a great day with the parenthesis of Tim and Arendsman.
Yes.
But I mean, they're not going to be riding for three riders. They're going to ride a three-week race and then figure out how they can aim for the podium. They're off to a great start. And I would say if you were to add up the pros and cons, with Narváez winning the stage, taking the first pink jersey, I think that's more than compensation for Arensman being, you know, off the boil.
Yes. Narváez, Brian, I have to say, they were pretty bullish in the Ineos camp. I don't think they have high hopes of him keeping the jersey tomorrow, but the Europa climb, which we're going to talk about later in the podcast, we'll talk about tomorrow's stage, is not the steepest. He's a fast finishing ruler who can climb. Extremely impressive what he did today. I'm sort of tempted to say if the climb had been 500 meters longer, then Pogacar would have dropped him, but he never really let the wheel go, did he?
No, and he knew exactly what he had to do, and he's, other than being a rather sort of complete, almost like classics type rider, you know, good on shorter climbs, good descender, he's also a great sort of finisher. Like, he's really so race smart, he knows how to position himself, and he made absolutely the most of what he possibly could do today. That was super impressive.
It was also good.
And what a guy to beat, you know what I mean? Like, everyone's only been talking about Pogacar, and here comes the second big Ecuadorian in pro cycling and wins.
Yeah, and the second Ecuadorian to really sort of show his best self for the Giro d'Italia, because of course this is a race that's been won by an Ecuadorian, Richard Carapaz, a couple of years ago. Brian, it was really nice to see Max Schachmann up there as well, because he's had a horrible 2 or 3 years. We heard earlier in the year from Rolf Aldag, his team manager, about the just sort of repeated bouts of illness that he's had of varying types. And
sounds like me after I started having kids.
Yeah. And every time he's looked as though he's going to be coming back to the sort of form that won him Paris-Nice on two occasions, he's encountered new problems. And over the last
few
weeks...
He's been an anti-hero, hasn't he?
Yeah, but over the last few weeks, he has just sort of been edging back to his best form. And he's a guy, you know... I remember the first Paris-Nice that he won. It was the first stage, a horrible day, rainy day, and it was a sort of finale, a bit like the San Vito climb today, a sort of 1 kilometer steep climb, and he went away with Julien Alaphilippe and beat Alaphilippe at the finish line. And well, as we heard there, Schachmann is quite an engaging character. He's quite an exuberant character. And I remember thinking after that race that this was a guy who was going to be... He was going to be one of the main figures of the next few years, not possibly not winning major tours, but certainly 1 week tours, and he was going to be a personality and a ride that we were going to enjoy sort of covering over a few years, and it's just not panned out that way. So it was really good to see him
and
back
I
where
think
he was.
In general, his team today, I think they rode really smart. They weren't intimidated by Pogacar. I don't think anyone who's riding as well as the guys who were up at the front, interesting part of the race today, weren't intimidated by him. They raced it as any other bike race, and he's just the main competitor.
Brian, we mentioned the riders who lost time today. I was listening to our good friend and colleague Rob Hatch and his commentary on Eurosport, and he was talking about the sort of shock at how many sort of big fishes were getting caught out. I must say, I wasn't that surprised. I looked at the profile today, and I couldn't have said who exactly they were going to be, but I always thought a couple of general classification riders would suffer today. Also because of the nature of the climbs, they were relatively short, but pretty steep, a short stage, you know, starting at 10 to 2 in the afternoon, everyone kind of coming in cold. It was going to be raced aggressive, it was going to be a lot of stress in the peloton. I was quite surprised when Schachmann said that they didn't go that fast on the Maddalena.
I think there's more than one opinion about that.
Yeah. But I did speak to Matt Winston briefly, DSM, Firmenich Post NL, Roman Bardet's direct sportive, and I asked him about what happened to Romain today, and he said that, well, he just had a bad 5 minutes. It wasn't even a bad day, because actually he rallied pretty well. He only lost weight, lost less than a minute, so they weren't too concerned.
I think he could still be on the podium.
Yeah,
I don't think there's any
kind of
indication of today that would give.
I think they were just glad to get today out of the way, and particularly two have limited their losses. Arensman's performance was more worrying, because he lost 2 minutes 27 seconds. Bardet was apparently complaining of stomach problems in the stage. But yeah, what a terrific stage that RCS laid on for us today. And the addition of that San Vito, because that San Vito climb was a late addition, that wasn't on the original route. And when they did add that, I think it was, it predated Wout van Aert's crash in Dwars door Vlaanderen, and people thought, well, this is another sort of incentive for Van Aert to go for the pink jersey on day one. And then they started to think that actually it would be perfect for Pogacar. It was perfect for Pogacar. It's just that he found two riders in his path who were on great days and who rode brilliantly in Narváez and Schachmann. Brian, Romain Bardet, you know who used to ride with Romain Bardet? You know, he used to be his teammate.
Well, there was probably quite a few riders, yeah, Daniel, that used, yeah, to be his teammate.
Very good friend.
You've been more specific.
Good friend of the cycling podcast. Very familiar
voice.
Oh,
obviously, like the Motown maestro.
Yeah, very familiar voice for listeners of the cycling podcast. And the Motown maestro, Brian, my internet has conked out. I can't tell you where Larry came in today. I shouted across the road at Larry when he did come over the line, and he seemed fine, but he didn't come in with the leaders. But he seemed to have had a decent day. Anyway, as we did last year, we're going to be checking in most days, or a lot of days, with Larry, and I did check in with him this morning at the Vinaria Reale. And that brings us to our first installment of L'Arranzando, a postcard from Italy with Larry Warbas.
L'Arranzando, a postcard from Italy, with Larry Warbas.
Oh, poor Larry. He's been asked for photos by people who don't know who he is.
Good. He wants a photo with everyone.
Larry, how are you?
Yeah, good. Feeling good. Sun's out. It's beautiful.
You're looking splendid. You're looking fresh. You're looking bright-eyed. Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose, Larry.
Yeah. No, I think it's going to be good. It's going to be a hard day, you know. A little bit nervous, actually. So that's a good thing. But, yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. It's like, yeah, it's kind of it's going to be a hard first Grand Tour stage. So a little bit different than what we're used to. A lot of times it's a TT or a sprint or something. So, yeah, not going to be easy, but it'll be a good day, I think.
Larry, this podcast comes out this evening, so you can tell us verbatim, what your director sportif said in the meeting this morning about the stage.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming that UAE will control. There might be a fight for the breakaway, but, you know, I don't think the breakaway, for me, has zero chance of going to the line. And then, yeah, for us, it's just trying to get Ben and Aurelien into the best position possible for the last time we hit that small climb. So, you know, if we can take it on the front, that's the objective. So, yeah, for me, like, if I can hopefully make it over the long climb, the Cat 2 climb near the finish, and, yeah, just try to take them first wheel into the bottom if we can. That's our objective. And then, you know, it's just the legs from there. So we'll do our best to take that climb as far forward as we can, and then, yeah, what happens. So I think the positioning is really, really important on the bottom of that last climb, because it's like less than 5k to go. So it's going to be a full gas fight going into the bottom.
Larry, just on your way to see me now, you just passed Tadej Pogacar, as you often pass him, of course, famously. Yeah. He talked in his press conference this week about it. Well, he said it was bullshit that kind of his rivals were being disrespected, that people were talking about this as though it's a one-horse race. The likes of Ben, do you think they feel disrespected?
Not at all. You know, I mean, I think they're just realistic, you know? It's like, I mean, it's nice that Tadej is a classy guy and, you know, he doesn't just assume it's already finished, you know, that's cool. And, I mean, I guess you shouldn't, because, yeah, then that's how you make errors. So, you know, I don't think anyone feels disrespected by that. You know, I think everyone respects Tadej and knows how incredible of a rider he is. And, yeah, once in a generation and potentially once, yeah, in history. We'll see. I don't know. So, no, I mean, I think, you know, it is what it is. So yeah.
Larry, I can see you're a little bit nervous, actually.
Really?
But yeah. nerves are good, aren't they? Do you embrace nerves? Do you can you recognize that it's a good thing?
Yeah, it's a good thing. I rarely get race nerves, so that's good. I usually get race nerves if, like, I can do well. And it's a big race, so...
So you're nervous because you know you're flying.
I think I'm in good shape, but I guess we'll see after today. So, no, I mean, I think I'll be good for this Giro. Whether those legs appear today or later on, that remains to be seen, but I think it's going to be a good race.
Well, I'll release you, Larry. Remember, we're in Piedmont, the home region of your international fan club, so that's a good
home. He's just over there.
I was just over there. You've already seen him.
Great. Yeah.
What's the sign like this year? Is it A4 paper still?
Oh, actually, it's a really nice sign. I think he got it professionally printed, so it's pretty cool. Yeah.
More money in cycling than there was a year ago. Larry, one final time. Clear eyes.
Well, I didn't remember.
Full heart, can't lose.
You're
a big Friday Night Lights fan, aren't you?
I actually haven't really watched it.
Who am I getting you mixed up with? Anyway, off you go. I mean, that's their words of wisdom from Coach Taylor in Friday Night Lights.
Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose. Can't lose!
Larry, we're all behind you.
Sounds great. Thanks, guys.
O'Brien, we heard before the break there from Larry, he was nervous. I could tell Larry was nervous this morning. And as I said to him there, it was good to see him nervous because it's good to get the sense that when riders come to races like this, because, you know, they do so many races in a year. And as we gathered speaking to Larry earlier in the week for our Kilometre Zero Live, the Grand Tours just hit different and they feel different and they taste different. And particularly for a guy like Larry, and this is a huge occasion for him. And The setting this morning in Venaria Reale was obviously very grand, and the crowds were fantastic. The crowds were great as well on the stage in general. And it was just nice to see not only Larry, but other riders as well, give off the air that they were about to embark on something very important in their lives and in their careers.
Is that how you felt as well, Daniel?
Well, it's always how I feel, Brian.
Great.
It's always how I feel. Brian, another regular feature that we're bringing back this year. Well, it's just an interview, really, but we're giving it a fancy name. The start this morning, Venaria Reale, a lot of team managers, a lot of familiar faces. The team managers tend to jet in for the start of Grand Tours. One team manager who's been very much in the news over the last week has been Ralf Denk of Bora Hansgrohe. Schachmann had a very good day, and Bora Hansgrohe had a pretty good day. But they have been in the news because finally, we've been hearing about this for a few months now, that the Red Bull partnership has been confirmed and a timetable has been established that Red Bull is going to become a naming sponsor, title sponsor, in time for the Tour de France. We still haven't seen the kit, although it's been sort of leaked on social media. And I believe the kit that has been leaked is pretty close to the real thing. I have it on good authority. Anyway, that's a lot of waffle to say that now we are going to have our next feature, which is the chin wag of the day, the chiacchierata del giorno, and it is with Ralf Denk. I spoke to him this morning in Venaria Reale about Red Bull, but also about something else that's been in the news. Emmanuel Buchmann being snubbed and not being selected for the Giro d'Italia.
Polemica.
La chiacchierata del giorno. The chin wag of the day.
Well, Ralf, you've had a busy morning by all accounts. You've rushed in here to the bus parking, but a busy morning, and it's been a busy couple of weeks because finally you've been able to announce this news to everyone when Red Bull is coming on board and a bit more about what they're going to be doing with the team. Can we go back to the start, Ralf, and tell the listeners, when was the seed of this planted?
Long time ago, 3.5 years, I sent a handwritten letter to Mr. Mateschitz. Can we do something together? I asked him. So Red Bull is not really big present in road cycling. It was really 3.5-4 years ago. And then I got immediately an answer. And then we had a meeting, not with him, but with the marketing team of Red Bull. And we discussed really, really small things at that time, 3-4 years ago. Small things was a transformation from Anton Palzer. I had a regress from him on my table. to his dream to be become a pro cyclist.
And that happened through Instagram, didn't it?
Yeah,
with Tony Pazza.
Yeah, he texts me on Instagram.
Tony Pazza, of course, the ski mountaineer who, well, he was the first rider to ride for your team with any Red Bull sort of logo or imagery.
This was a first project what we did together with Red Bull. Another project, very successful, come some years later, was the the Red Bull Junior Brothers. This is a globally scouting project for 15 and 16 years old kids that can apply via Zwift to get a spot in our under 19 team. So this was the second project. Then the project is we can use the APC, the Athlete Performance Center. And step by step, yeah, we move forward. And at the same time, cycling changed a lot. Was really a huge influence from the Arabic countries to invest, from external investors in our sport. Look to UAE, look to Team Bahrain, look to Team Jake Waula, a sponsor from Saudi. So. And the budget are growing and growing, growing, growing. And yeah, I'm the founder and the CEO of the team Borohansgrohe, and I have to find a way how we deal it with this new money what come in, and significant increase of all the team budgets. And so, yeah, I was also sitting in the last Tour de France with some sheikhs and the plan to invest in pro cycling, and was not really well feeling for me at that time. And at that time, I asked Red Bull as well, hey, can we discuss something bigger? Set up a plan? And they say yes. And then
straight away, was it difficult to persuade them at that point?
I invite them to the Tour de France, and at the Tour de France, they saw, I think, in the first time, how big is our sport, how much are their potential, and how much are the heritage in this sport. And they saw as well the potential of increase of the whole business model, in my opinion, because our business model is very old school, and we are a very traditional sport, and maybe we can change this together with Red Bull as well in another direction to make the cake in general bigger. And this was also small impacts to bring Red Bull on board. And from the last Tour de France, when they visit us, the project speed up, and in January we make the request in the government authorization, and we get green light. And from end of January until now, we work really hard on the papers, on the details, on the structure. Here we are.
Can you give me an example, or have they already made a concrete difference? Have they already had a tangible impact, or is that still to come?
I will say in the moment it's for all departments more work, because we have to build up the general structure. And but we will see the impact soon, I think. The budget is not more so tight. We can do, as a small example, more days in altitude. We will have in the main races a bit more stuff. So step by step, but so far the impact is not really big.
You see one impact of Red Bull. You got all the agents waiting to speak to you, Ralph. You got a big queue of agents. Ken Sommer's here. And the line of agents is getting longer and longer.
The agents are very welcome. They bring us the next super talent.
Very last thing, Ralph. We're at the Giro d'Italia. Your team's been in the news a bit this week. There's been a lot of talk on social media about Emil Buchmann, who wasn't picked for the Giro. What would you like to say? What would you like to communicate about that? And his, well, his Instagram post expressing his disappointment.
It was also for me disappointing because Emil became pro in my team. Was always well supported in the best way. What we can do for him in the past, and for sure I understand him as well. Was disappointed not to be lined up in the Giro, but I have to mention as well, we promised him never a co-leadership or co-leader role, and when Lennart or when was clear Lennart will not race the Giro due his injury, then yeah, of course we have to restructure the team, and we had not a spot from not a spot for him. But to be honest, if we look back to all the season results so far, yeah, Emo was not really coming up with big arguments. And this is also if he comes with 10 season victories so far, yes, for sure. But in modern cycling, it's not just a focus on one highlight per year. So you have to be in shape from January more or less until October. And if you look to the top star riders, and okay, here, we have a lot of top star riders, and they proof already the shape during the spring. And but in general, was his decision to bring this all up in the media. In personal, I have nothing against Emo, but this move was also for me as a long-time supporter hard.
Disappointing. Ralph, thank you very much for your time. I'm going to leave you now to the agents.
Okay, thank you. Ta-ta.
Brian, could hear this sort of disappointment, the real genuine disappointment there in Ralph Denk's voice about Emo Buchmann. And I spoke to a few other people in and around the team this morning, and they're quite mystified by Buchmann publicly expressing his distaste for Bora Hansgrohe not picking him. They sort of suggested to me that it was never on the cards that he was going to be co-leader at the Giro. And then, of course, Leonard Kemner had his crash in Tenerife, and everything, all the plans had to be ripped up. Whether at that point Buchmann assumed that because Kemner wasn't going to be riding the Giro d'Italia, then he would be the sort of substitute leader, I don't know. However, as we heard there, Ralph Denk pointing out, Buchmann's results haven't been great. He's riding well at the moment. He rode well the other day in Frankfurt. As you say, polemica.
Can I just say, Daniel, that I've seen this happen numerous times. And I've seen it happen numerous times as well on really big teams. There's a lot going on at the wherever Ralph Denk's office is. You know, there's the Red Bull deal. They're trying to figure out a performance plan. I'm sure they have already for Roglic. Fitting in, they've just announced a new contract for Hindley. They're getting the team ready. Sometimes I think that from an outsider's perspective, people will be surprised how little communication there can be on quite significant elements
Brian,
the inside of a team.
This is something that I'm hearing more and more in as teams get bigger and they become quite bloated, and they don't, you know, they no longer have one doctor or one physio. They have three physios and five doctors, and sometimes it is very difficult to connect all those dots and to get everyone talking to each other. Brian, riders being snubbed, riders not being picked. Another one who was in the news, has been in the news the last few days, Wout Poels, Bahrain victorious. There's been a lot less sort of, he's known, I think, about the reasons why he wasn't picked for the Giro d'Italia. A lot of people sort of guessing, kind of led to believe there was a race earlier this year where there was maybe a bit of a disagreement between him and Directs Sportifs about tactics, and that might explain that might be one reason why he wasn't picked for the Giro d'Italia. Of course, he really wanted to be here because he's lacking the Giro d'Italia in his otherwise complete collection of Grand Tour stage wins.
I sometimes I think stuff like that doesn't really make a lot of sense. You know, it's just the professional athletes, they aren't a bunch of teenagers, you know, and there will always be disagreement in the race because the rider is in the race, the sports director is in the team car. Usually, at least on most teams I've worked with, they'll do a debrief in the bus afterwards, and whatever kind of disagreement will need to be ironed out there. And then once you get off the bus and you're at the hotel, it's over. So I often find that in those situations, even if the rider's in the wrong, it's a management problem, not a rider problem.
Brian, last night we had a brief discussion because I won't identify them, but we were dining in a restaurant, and a couple of agents that we're acquainted with were also dining in that.
The real power players of professional cycling.
Yeah. We're also dining in that restaurant, and we did talk to a couple of them, and one of the subjects of conversation was how contracts are being signed earlier and earlier, and in fact, you know, we used to say and we used to think that the sort of rest days of the Tour de France were absolutely key as far as signing new contracts were concerned. And then, you know, there was a period sort of maybe 5-10 years ago when people used to talk about the Giro as being absolutely vital. And now, based on what we heard last night and based on what we've seen as well, April is a key month. And there does seem to be, well, in certain teams, there is this kind of culture of punishing riders who are possibly not going to remain with the team the following year. And if that's happening in April, then it means you've got a rider who's doing nothing for 9 months or so. Well,
yes,
8 months.
Yes and no. I mean, as per the standard contract with the UCI, a rider actually can demand to be in races, and they can't just bench them as you can in football. But once again, this is another thing that always amazed me, that let's say that you have a rider who's on a one-year contract, those do still exist. You sign them and then they can't ride the big races because you don't know where they're going the year after. I've always been of the opinion that if you own a team, if you manage a team, if you make key decisions about who's racing where, you are always obliged, looking at, you know, all the nuts and bolts of what makes the season, to bring the strongest possible team to the big races. I don't, like, how can it be any, like, if you aren't doing that, I don't think you're worth your money.
Brian, I mentioned briefly our dinner last night. Let's talk a little bit more about that now, shall we? And also about tomorrow's stage.
La tappa di domani e la cena di ieri. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Brian, last night's dinner, and we actually did a bit of an impromptu podcast last night. It was on I put it on Substack. I can load it onto the Cycling Podcast Substack. I think it's been loaded. I think Lionel's loaded it onto there now, so you should be able to listen to that sort of shambolic 8 minutes, not a monologue.
It was like a mic test.
Yeah, it was basically a long mic test, a long and probably tedious mic test, in a place called Scanabue, which is like the slaughter the cow, we called it. But
we actually tried to get
terrific.
A table there again tonight. That's how good it was.
But the food was terrific. I had the highlight of my meal, Brian, was definitely risotto. It was a pea risotto, and with robiola cheese. Robiola, where's the robiola from? Is it from Piedmont? I think.
It's from Piedmont. Yeah, I would say that. Yeah. If we do corrections corner, that I'm pretty certain that it's a Piedmont cheese.
I think it's either Piedmont or it's definitely the north.
It's robiola though, isn't it?
No, robiola. Yeah, definitely robiola. And we had some Nebbiolo as well. We had some lovely Piedmontese wine. Brian, what did you have? Yeah, you had Vitello Tonnato, which is the classic.
Well, I'm taking a page out of your book because you're very sort of kilometer zero-ish with what we're drinking, what we're eating, what we're looking at when we're at the Giro, which I think is great. So I also had a tagliarin, a local pasta, I would say. It's probably
sort of fine pasta, isn't it?
Yeah, like a flatter type of, like a narrower type of fettuccine, round. And it was with salsiccia and leeks. And it was great. Mm. It was really nice, not too heavy. And I would have sworn like a couple of weeks ago that I would go full vegetarian. It's hard now, so I'll have to like...
You had an incident. We'll talk about that later in the Giro. You had an incident a couple of weeks ago which affected your form and fitness for this Giro d'Italia, but you're recovering well.
Actually, kind of almost died, but thank you.
It affected his form and fitness. Brian, tomorrow's stage, please. Where are we going?
Well, Daniel, we are actually starting in San Francesco al Campo, not far from Turin. It's a... In Giro terms, a relatively short stage, 161 kilometers. And the arrival is of mythical proportions because we're going to the Santuario di Europa, which I've read an article today where Paolo Bettini, he's commentating on each stage in the Saturday supplement of La Gazzetta dello Sport. It says, like, it's spelled Europa, but you pronounce it Pantani.
Brian, tell us about that last, that very famous last climb to the Santuario di Europa.
Yeah, so the climb sort of really starts in Biella. So very
home of Fila Sportswear.
I was about to say Menabrera.
Menabrera Bia. Were you with me a couple of years ago? They've got a pizzeria at the bottom of them. So I'm not sure if you get Menabrera. I think you do get it outside of Italy. In fact, you do get it outside of Italy.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of the most famous Italian beers.
You just pay three times as much.
Yeah, it's a nice beer.
It's a great beer.
And the brewery,
it's like a posh pilsner.
Yeah, the brewery's at the bottom, but they also have a nice pizzeria at the bottom of the, right at the bottom of the Europa climb.
So on the climb in question, the Europa climb, it's officially 11.8 kilometers long, altitude gain of 773 meters. The average, but this is quite deceiving, the average is 6.2%, but it's sort of like starts fairly easy, and then there's a...
It's harder, doesn't it?
Yeah, it gets quite hard. There's a couple of kilometers, almost 2 kilometers, where it's at almost 9.5%. There's a really steep bit at the end at 14%. But the last sort of the significant part of the climb is like 5 kilometers, which I think will average almost 8%.
Yes. It's a climber's climb, but it's also a bit of a time trialist climb. In fact, the last time we went up there, Tom Dumoulin was the winner. That was on that stage. There was only one significant climb. Tomorrow, there are a couple of Prelude, Antipasti. One of them, Brian's got an intriguing name, and it's an intriguing destination. It's an intriguing location. It's called the Oasi Zegna, the Zegna Oasis. Now, this intrigued me. I did a bit of a research. You have as well, and I wondered whether it had something to do with the tailor, the men's, is it men's and women's wear, brand.
Ermenegildo Zegna.
Ermenegildo Zegna, who has created he's dead now, isn't he?
Well, it's a nature reserve, and a big one of that is 100 square kilometers, and it's open to the public, no entrance fee, and it's really a park, so you almost call like a natural park that's it's privately owned but open to the public. And it was actually created all the way back in 1910, and it has around 500,000 different plantations, a real, like, so it actually isn't an oasis in the sense of the flora and the fauna. You know what, I have to be honest, I've never heard of it, but looking at photos in preparation for this, it looks absolutely beautiful. And it's actually, it is the first categorized climb of the day. It's a category 3 climb, and then there's 3 categorized climbs, and the second one is a category 3 as well, and then the Europa is Cat 1 climb.
This seems to be a bit of a thing among Italian fashion magnates. I base that on 2 examples. One, the Oasi Zegna, and Renato Rosso, who is the founder, creator, owner of the Diesel brand. He has his own estate near Marostica in the Veneto.
He'll probably be hiding there, because I saw a headline today in the newspaper where an ex-wife, I believe, was...
Of Renato
in
Rosso.
And one of the major Italian newspapers were... She was throwing all kinds of allegations at him.
Well, he has this estate just outside Marostica, which has become a feature in Pippo Pozzato's races.
It's always been something with, like, snow-washed jeans with holes across the kneecap, isn't this real, like, a professional
careful,
bike rider's kind of like...
Careful what you say, because I worked for that organization last year.
But I'm absolutely right.
Yes, but Renato also has this estate. Ermenegildo Zegna has put his name, their name, to an estate as well, which have now, as of tomorrow, we're both featuring bike races. Brian, the one thing, we talked to quite a bit about Europa in our preview, and we talked about this now legendary stage in 1999 where Marco Pantani's chain dropped at the pretty much the base of the climb, and then he caught and overtook, I think it was 49 riders, I looked this up, and I said how it kind of made me queasy. One thing that struck me, Brian, re-listening to our 1998 sort of nostalgia fest about the 1998 and Giro d'Italia and the Pantani double that year. I didn't make this point in that podcast, but the nostalgia for that era, it has an extra sort of, an extra kind of potency to it, because usually when you think about the past, you're thinking about a time when things weren't as advanced, weren't as good, weren't as fast. However, when you think back to that age, we know, unfortunately, that era was kind of supercharged in professional cycling, and they kind of were using technologies which we like to think are no longer used. So in a certain sense,
being a bit cagey with your semantics here.
You know what I mean. So professional cycling, it's a kind of case of back to the future, and consequently, you know, when you watch those images, you're not sort of thinking, oh, this kind of version of cycling is not very good. You're actually thinking it's better than, well, it's almost faster than today's cycling, particularly when they go uphill, which it's for the wrong reasons, obviously, and it's for morally reprehensible reasons.
But when you say almost, I would almost ask you to qualify that, because I actually believe we live in an era now where the racing is more entertaining, where there's more,
yeah,
sort of
it is
larger than
but,
life.
But you know what I mean?
Riders.
It's almost as though they were, you know, you could, instead of thinking about doping and talking about doping, imagine that back then they were using bikes which are better than the bikes they're allowed to use now. It's almost.
You think so?
No, even. Hypothetically.
Got it.
So, again, that sense of, okay, when you look back on the past, you kind of think of it as, yeah, it's romantic, it's cool, it evokes sort of feelings, but it's kind of stale by comparison to the present day. And you don't really get that to the same extent when you look at 1999, you look at Pantani, you kind of think, wow.
Well, we all know how that 1999 Giro ended.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It was a short-lived
heyday
of our, you know, nostalgia, I would say.
And Brian, we're going to conclude, prediction for tomorrow. We think that the Pogacar iteration will probably take place tomorrow. I think he'll probably take the pink jersey. But it'll be interesting to see how long Narvaez is able to hang on, and whether, I think some of the time trials, I think Filippo Ganna might do well tomorrow. I think Geraint Thomas, based on how he rode today, will do well tomorrow in that final climb. He'll be really relieved about the way the Giro started for him tonight. But Brian, staying in the present day, in the present moment, we talked a lot in the run-up to this Giro d'Italia about Grande Torino. We talked a lot about the anniversary of the Superga disaster. That was
where
today.
Were you at 17:03, by the way?
Well, I would have been on the finish line, I think.
Because did you hear that there was actually it was either like a military jet or something? There was a plane that flew over the Superga, so there was also like a visual commemoration of that tragic day.
Well, we have talked a lot about it. I went up there this morning. I ran up there, posted a video on Instagram by the memorial. I also met Diego Fornero, of the author behind the L'Invincibile podcast, which we heard. Well, we heard him in my Kilometer Zero about Grande Torino. And yes, it's been a poignant day in Turin. For that reason, did you know the Mole Antonelliana, which is the iconic, the old synagogue in Turin, Turin's most iconic building, there's a badge, a Torino badge that's projected on there today to commemorate the 75th anniversary.
I also think
the
there's something quite telling about the fact that, you know, that's obviously a reason why the Giro starts here on this day, etc. But it also shows that sport has a lot in common. You know what the dreams we have, the people that we love, the riders or football players we're fans of, and it's also about you aren't able to reduce cycling to, oh, there's just like a bunch of guys riding for A to B and the fastest one gets a pink T-shirt, or your football is just 22 players running around on a field of grass after a leather ball. There's so much more to it, and you can see today that. I mean, you saw also on the Superga, there was a huge group of Grande Torino fans, you know, in those colors and cheering on the riders. So I think often you say sports are very quite isolated unless it's the Olympics, but they do actually have a lot in common. And one of those things is love.
Indeed, Brian. And in fact, I've decided that we're going to play out today and this evening with another little sort of tribute, little homage to Grande Torino. As I said, I went up this morning to Superga. We're going to hear a little, sort of vignette from me, this morning. We're also going to hear again the song that we heard in my Grande Torino, in our Grande Torino episode, Un Giorno di Pioggia by Senso Unico. They're fans of Torino. And we... Sorry, Brian?
No, I was about to say, you know, I interviewed the goalkeeper for... He was the second goalkeeper of Grande Torino. And it's, I did it some 15 years ago for a Danish football magazine. And I wasn't that good at Italian back then, but it was quite poignant what he said, because he lost all his teammates that day. And he was supposed to be on that airplane, but because the third goalkeeper was the brother of one of the most significant defenders, he said to me that he felt ashamed not dying that day because his life was actually over after that. It was very, very sad and very significant personal story for him as well. And it gives me goosebumps just thinking about that wonderful old man.
Well, on that note, Brian, we will finish for tonight. And we remember Grande Torino, the greatest football team, some would say, that Italy has ever seen, who perished on Superga 75 years ago today. 8:41, a beautiful morning in Turin, in Torino, above Torino as well, because I'm up at the Basilica di Superga, where of course the race is going to be later on today. But obviously this week we've been talking a lot about the Grande Torino, and we had our episode earlier in the week about the 75th anniversary of the plane crash that caused the death of the Grande Torino, Italy's greatest ever football team, team that won 5 Italian league titles in the 1940s. Their dominance kind of straddled the Second World War, and well, it's been a moving, rewarding experience just immersing myself in that whole story this week, and to come up here today is pretty special. The Giro as well, coming past here. The climb itself, I haven't got the route in front of me. I don't know how many kilometers the climb Superga is, but I was thinking earlier on my way running up here, which took me rather longer than 15 minutes. In our episode, we talked about this phenomenon of the Quarto d'Ora Granata, the garnet 15 minutes in Grande Torino games. There was a gentleman in the crowd that was armed with a trumpet, and when the team needed him, he used to get up, or he felt they needed him, he used to get up, blow his trumpet, and then something called the Quarto d'Ora Granata, and that was when the team would, well, they would take it as their cue to really put their foot on the accelerator, and often they sort of obliterated teams in that period. But it struck me earlier that maybe the climb to Superga will probably last about 15 minutes, I'm guessing. Could be a Quarto d'Ora Granata. I've just walked around the front now. One thing I think I also mentioned, or John Foote also mentioned in that episode, was that all of the old Savoy royal family is buried up here. I just walked around the side of the basilica, past where all the tombs are, and now I'm around the front of the basilica. The plane crashed into the back, and that's where the monument is, but around the front got an extraordinary view of Turin and the Alps behind, and in particular center stage, the Monviso. It also features on Stacey Snyder's cups this year as the sort of backdrop to Superga. And there used to be, well, it's known as the Re di Pietra, the Stone King, the Monviso, so the mother mountain of Piedmont, and the Piedmontese, covered in snow at the moment. There's also this legend, myth, it is a myth, that the Paramount Pictures logo was based on the silhouette, the form of the Monviso, and that's kind of been debunked, like a lot of myths in Italy, and like a lot of myths, usually culinary myths, that we'll talk about during this Giro d'Italia. But as I said, a very rewarding experience to come up here today. It was a bit of a pilgrimage, a bit of a sort of rite of passage that I had promised myself that I would do. It was a tough climb, I have to say, up from the centre of Torino, about 400 metres of climbing, and about 10 kilometres from where we're staying. I think I might get a taxi back or a bus. Anyway, I'm glad I did it.
Le mani mai ferme, portate la bocca.
Diego Fornero, people who listen, the listeners of the Cycling Podcast, after those who have listened to the special we did on Grande Torino will be familiar, I hope, with your voice. But it's lovely to meet you in person, finally. We had a nice long conversation about Grande Torino a couple of weeks ago. You're here at the start in Veneria Reale. And Diego, a very special day, isn't it? I've already told you, I've been up to Superga, and it is the anniversary, the 75th anniversary. I was just telling you, I bought the local newspaper La Stampa this morning. I was curious to see what other things are being done, organised. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about that today. And how important is this day?
Let me say, it's always a special day. When it comes to May 4th, it always feels something special to me, to us, to people that actually have in their heart what happened to Grande Torino. Now it's 75 years, it's a lot. And again, it's not something that is history, it's more something that is more like, I really feel like a sense of belonging to what happened to this team. And from one side, it's an important day. From another side, we celebrate, but also we feel like something that is still, let me say, painful, even if it's been a lot of years. So it's not a party, it's not like a celebration. And maybe it's the reason why people from the outside feel like, we are not having something special, something different than usual. It's more like a moment where to gather, where to stay together, where to commemorate what happened. So
that moment, what form does that moment take every year? It's a procession. Because this morning when we ran up there, on the way down, we saw a lot of Toro fans already making their way up. But is that all day there'll be people walking up there?
Yeah, no, there will be a celebration at 5 p.m. That is the moment in which actually the crash happened 75 years ago. And then there will be a holy mass in Superga Basilica. And then the team will go in front of the monument, and there will be the captain reading the names of all the Grande Torino players and all the people that died in the accident. And maybe it's not going to be probably the captain, probably will be the vice captain. Captain, that is Alessandro Buongiorno.
Why not the captain?
Yeah, because Alessandro Buongiorno is born in Turin, grew up in Torino, is a true Torino heart, and so he's the most symbolic player to choose. It happened also last year. And I think we'll be every time I'm there, and I have I've been lucky enough to be there also really in front of the players in the past, and it's really heartbreaking, let me say, something really, really intense. And it's a moment where we actually gather and celebrate. Obviously there's no space for everyone, because you've been in Superga, it's really, really little the spot, but it's important to be there, at least with our heart and with our minds.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.